Hello and welcome to the Investors Chronicle Companies and Markets Show. I'm John Heumann, editor of the Investors Chronicle. I'm joined today by Stephen Wilmot, Companies Editor.
Hello, John.
How are you doing?
Good, thanks.
Good. And Jonas Crosland, who is one of our writers, covers a number of financial sectors and property.
That's right. Hi, John.
How are you doing?
Not too bad.
Excellent. Good of you to join us today. And over in the control room is Mark Robinson. How are you doing, Mark?
So I am. Okay.
Excellent. You're going to talk to us today about North Sea Oil.
Yeah, a little bit about the tax message in the budget.
Indeed, because it is budget week. And although we will not go into an enormous amount of detail about the budget, because we will have covered that in our personal finance podcast, which we recorded this morning. A lot of that regarding pension freedom rules and the new ISA allowances and all of that lovely stuff will be covered in that. So go off and have a listen to that once you've had a listen to this, of course. But yeah, there is some stuff in the budget, as Mark said, around North Sea Oil, which is quite interesting. There is some stuff in the budget around the life assurance industry that's quite interesting that we will touch on very briefly. But before we do that, let's talk a little bit about what's been going on in the US, because this was the week in which the Federal Reserve removed the word patient from its guidance, and this apparently has enormous significance. I mean, have you been following this insane Fed watching that goes on?
Yeah, no, it's quite extraordinary, isn't it? But I mean, it seems that there were points that both bulls and bears could draw on. So yes, the removal of the word patient was critical for the for those who think that they're about to raise interest rates.
Mm.
But at the same time, they also sort of stress the data contingency of interest rate increases. So
sounds a bit like Carney's forward guidance.
Yeah, exactly. So, and you know, they stress that because of the rising dollar, and exports weighing on exports, that there's a bit more slack in the economy than they thought. So, yeah, they've removed the word patient, but there's also more slack than they thought. So actually, we saw the dollar fall yesterday, and the stock market jump, suggesting that it's as dovish as it always was.
Yeah, well, I wrote my editorial on this subject, and I wish I hadn't at 6 o'clock last night when the statement actually came out. I thought we'd have gone to press by then, so we didn't. And so I had to make a last minute change because I was preempting the removal of the word patient, and by the time we went to press, it had happened. So, I guess the thought was that by becoming less patient, the Fed would be looking to interest rate rises in the summer, and now that's not a certainty at all.
Yeah, it just seemed. I think some people have pushed. I mean, I noticed Schroeder's, for example, their economics team pushed back the date at which they expect the first interest rate increase in response to the meeting yesterday. Mm.
So, what did they say? When do they think it's going to happen then?
I don't know. They didn't specify, but they just said they'd push back their interest rate, their expectation.
It's interesting that you say you don't know, because I think this is what it all boils down to, and nobody actually knows what's going through all the Fed watching.
Mm.
I think we are still in fairly uncertain times. And, as I mentioned in the editorial, economic data recently has not been great. The IMF, the World Bank, and as George Osborne mentioned yesterday, the Office of Budget Responsibility have said that global growth is downgraded.
It seems they really need to have every argument in line to want to raise interest rates.
Yeah.
Clearly, not every argument is ever going to be in line. So I'm sure they'll come up with plenty of excuses.
Well, and it has been said that, by certain people that, we are not going to see interest rate rises here or in the US or anywhere else for a very, 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 very long time.
Yeah, the secular stagnation argument, of course, plays into that as well.
Absolutely, absolutely. Okay, well, we're none the wiser as to when interest rates might rise. What else has been going on? The budget. Let's go back to the budget. North Sea Oil. Mark, this is... You're not convinced by the apparent giveaway in the budget this week, are you?
Well, unfortunately, it's more the same. We've got here a reduction in the supplementary level, which is effectively a reversal of an earlier policy that was instigated by George Osborne back in 2011. And so we're sort of standing still on that score. The overall rate is down, and the Treasury says that it's going to mean a £1.3 billion boost for the industry. But unfortunately, these measures should have been taken a number of years ago, because looking at the sort of projects that we get in the North Sea, they're expensive, long dated, and above anything else, the companies that initiate these projects want some sort of transparency about their likely cost base in the future, and that includes taxation. That was taken away in 2011, and so we've had a gradual fall away. We've now got something in the region of £22 billion worth of assets up for sale in the North Sea, and there's been a dearth of buyers up till now. We don't know if these tax initiatives will change that in the near term. What the Chancellor didn't mention as well was to give some further clarity on decommissioning costs, because whoever's going to be trying to pick up these assets in the North Sea, assuming they do, they want some clarity on that, because, you know, if you were buying a mature field in the North Sea, you wouldn't want to be lumbered with the costs of taking it out of production.
Was there any response from the industry?
Well, fairly muted, really. I think it was pretty much in line with what a lot of people were expecting. The oil price itself is weakened over the last few days, partly due to the fact that the political atmosphere between Iran and the United States seems to be thawing somewhat on the nuclear issue. That could see an extra 800,000 barrels of oil enter global markets in fairly short order, which would obviously depress prices even further. So I think what's happened here with North Sea, as in a lot of the budget, actually, it's just wallpapering over the cracks. I think that the damage was done a number of years ago, and it would take far more radical surgery to bring it back into rude health.
Thank you, Mike. We'll come back onto oil in a bit, because Stephen, you're going to talk about your taking stock column, which talks about yield, the hunt for yield, and obviously some of the bigger oil producers have been decent dividend payers. But we've got a bit of a theory about this. So let's come on to that later. Thank you, Mark. We'll come back to you in a minute. The other big company news in the budget was obviously the pensions industry, which we expected.
Yes, it was widely leaked over the weekend, but the news that 5 million existing annuity holders in the UK will be able to cash in their annuities, so it's no longer an irreversible decision.
But we don't think that's a problem, do we, necessarily, for the guys that are in that industry?
Well, yeah, there was speculation about how precisely this was going to be framed, and it would have been a bad thing for the life insurers, because obviously the life insurers have this embedded value, which is that they only take a portion of the profit on annuities they sell now, and the rest goes into embedded value. And obviously if that had become uncertain, then they would have had to have feasibly taken write-downs on that. But it doesn't look like it will be, because people won't have the option to simply sell their annuity back to the provider. What will happen is that sort of third parties will be able to come in and bid for those annuities, so that a secondary market is established. But if that's the case, then it doesn't actually affect the life insurer's sales. If a third party wants to come up and offer £80,000 for a £100,000 annuity, and the pensioner says, "Yeah, sure," then that doesn't affect the original profit that Standard Life or Legal & General or Aviva made on the annuity. So, from what we can see at the moment, I mean, it is subject to technical consultation, but from what we can see at the moment, they're going to go down that third party platform route, which doesn't look like it'll be. I mean, in fact, it may be a plus for the industry, because they'll be able to bid for this business themselves and create a new earning stream by buying up annuities at discounts from those people who want to, who are foolish enough, frankly, to want to sell them.
But then I guess there are people out there who'd rather have the cash.
In certain emergency situations, I mean, people's life circumstances do change, and I guess that's the insight underpinning this legislation, and it's not such a bad thing. But I would have thought for the vast majority of people it would be very foolish.
Indeed, interesting stuff, which we're going to explore in more detail next week, because we've got a big feature coming out on pension freedom, which we'll explore all of this in much greater detail than we can do here. Okay, well, that's the big picture. Let's have a look on a more micro scale. Let's start with some of the companies that we've covered this week. Morrison, one of our favourites.
The lead results in this week's section is Morrison's, which announced that it was going to cut 23 underperforming convenience stores. Now, what's interesting about that is not so much that that's a huge number, but that it only rushed into convenience stores a couple of years ago. So
yeah,
it's just a sign of the strategic chaos, really.
Well, we talked about this earlier. We talked about the same thing applying to its foray into online.
Exactly.
Which from the state, reading between the lines of the statement, doesn't appear to be going quite as well as they thought it might as well.
I mean, it was, Dalton Phillips was for many years accused of two things, being behind the curve on convenience stores and being behind the curve on online. And then they made up for lost time. And surprise, surprise, when you rush into something, you don't do it very well and you end up with bad locations. And for the convenience stores, they said that a third of their convenience stores weren't working as well as they'd hoped.
Well, I'm not surprised because I've seen there are three of these M locals near me, and one of them is in a town centre which is pedestrianised, which, you know, it's not exactly the place you would stop off to pick up a few bits on the way home, which I find odd. It's in an old Burger King. The other is in a pub, which is kind of a sort of out of town pub, which apparently, speaking to a cab driver recently, does okay. And the other one is in a high street opposite Marks and Spencer's. And I was in a Marks and Spencer's food hall the other day, and it was packed full of pensioners, as I discussed last week, and Morrison's was empty. And you mentioned that they bought one near you as well.
Yeah, they've opened one in just a couple of months ago near where I live, and it's really not in a prime location at all. I mean, for one thing, it's on a one-way street, which doesn't, you know, lend itself to traffic flows.
Precisely.
And it's in a bit of a no man's land between sort of various sort of village centres in London, and whereas Tesco has the one on the main road, and there's a Co-op on the main road, and it just looks like Morrison's got there late.
Had
to pick up, you know, the last bit of retail property being flogged by a developer in London. And has been left with something which is underperforming. I mean, okay, that probably they won't assess that one probably for, you know, they have to leave them open for a year or so before, to work out whether it'll do okay. Maybe this one will build up the trade, but judging by the location, I wouldn't have thought it'll do well.
No.
So they're not just shutting 23, but they're also radically scaling back the pace of the expansion, which I think started, we're saying, with the demise of Blockbuster and Jessop's a few years ago. They kind of decided that they'd take on a lot of leases, and that doesn't, you know, instill faith in a strategy of picking, you know, good supermarket locations one by one, does it? The idea that they would sort of buy a wholesale load of leases from a failed retailer in a completely different sector.
It's
when you rush things that they don't go well. That's, I think, the motto of the story.
And they're going to cut their dividend as well.
Yeah, to no less than 5p.
Well, that's encouraging. Which is what? That's less than half level.
That's about 2.4% yield on the share price as it was when we wrote the story, which was just over 200p.
So. Well, indeed. Well, I guess that, you know, I mean, so if you look at the dividend yield as stated in this article, it's 6.7%, which I guess chimes with something we say often, which is don't buy something for a high yield alone, because very often it points to the fact that a cut may be on the way. Okay,
we may talk about this in reference to oil and gas.
Indeed. Well, let's come back to that in a minute. Morrison's got a new chief exec. Let's not write it off just yet. Yeah. There have been some very serious mistakes made at that company, quite clearly.
But there's a new chief exec, and there is maybe a recovery story.
So let's maybe come back to that, and I'll reserve judgment for the
time being. We have the shares on a hold, on a neutral hold, should stress.
One we like, though, a company we like, which have results this week, Cineworld.
Yes.
Cineworld is a fantastic company.
One of your favourites, I know.
It is. I like going to the cinema. And actually, my local cinema is a Cineworld. I think it's a good business. But I mean, one of the things I've always known about this business, and we have had it on a buy for a long, long time, and it's been, you know,
we have. But the most recent tip was in January, and it's already up 17% since, which is interesting. But I mean, that tip was predicated on a sort of this is a good quality buy on weakness, because it didn't have a great year last year. There weren't great releases, and also it had a rights issue at the beginning of the year to fund a big acquisition, so
which was in Eastern Europe.
Yeah, so it had a bit of a year of consolidation, well, as they euphemistically say.
Well, my view is that the businesses like Cineworld are hostage somewhat to the release schedule, so, you know, if the slate of films for a year is not strong, then they're not going to do that well.
But the good news is, in 2015,
looking pretty good.
Exactly.
50 Shades of Grey. I'm there. Not. You seen 50 Shades of Grey yet, Jonas?
No.
But in all seriousness, that has been huge.
Yes, apparently it gave them record levels of weekend admissions.
Yeah.
When it opened on Valentine's Day.
It tells you all you need to know about the British pub.
I must say, I did have to read that sentence twice in the release before I believed it.
No, I can believe it. But this year we've got a Bond film coming out. And Bond's always massive.
Yeah.
The UK box office, and a new Star Wars film, and a new Hunger Games film, and Yeah, looking pretty good. Looking pretty good. It goes chimes with something that Harriet's been saying for a while.
Harriet is out, covers the leisure sector.
That, you know, people are spending more of their disposable income on experiences these days, whether that be going to a restaurant or going to the cinema. So, yeah, we like that. Okay, I mean, talking of entertainment, there is another company that we like, which is Merlin Entertainment. We heard they have not had results this week. Merlin operates a number of theme parks, Legoland,
Madame Tussauds.
is it Thorpe Park? Thorpe Park? Alton Towers? I can never remember.
Yeah, Alton, anyway, it's Alton Towers.
Alton Towers. So we like that because, I mean, I don't know if you've ever taken, Jonas, have you ever taken your family to Legoland?
Yeah, never again.
And, I mean, how much was the mortgage you had to take, your family to Legoland?
Yeah, well, it was the 1 hour queue and the 90 second rides that put me off.
Yeah, it's quite expensive as well. Yeah. And it is very expensive. But you know, as you say, it is so popular that the queues are enormous. But there's a slightly different way to play this popularity.
Yeah, through its landlord.
Through its landlord.
Jonas wrote up the results this week of Secure Income REIT, and we initiated, didn't we, on a buy. I mean, take us through the...
Yeah, well, they hold freehold of all these things, and they have two tenants. Merlin is one, and the other one is a hospital group, which is, I think, one of the biggest private hospital groups
Ramsay Healthcare.
That's right. Yeah.
Is that a UK operator or is that
Ramsay? No, yeah. It's Australian.
Oh right, okay. So they've got property in Australia as well.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and it's a nice setup, but I mean, there's no dividend at the moment because they're very heavily geared. But once they refinance in a couple of years' time, the interest rates will come down on their debt. And so they have more money to spare on a dividend. Also, they're generating lots of cash, so their loan-to-value rate is coming down. I think it was about 80%. Previously, it's 70% in the last financial year. And they are thinking, well, they've kind of tested the water with Madame Tussauds to see if anyone wants to buy it for a silly price. I think about $300 million. Mooted. So if they sell that, obviously that'll bring down the debt considerably.
There's another reason we like that is because actually their previous venture, so this was Secure Income, was floated off by a company called Pressbury, which is run by a guy called Nick Leslau and another guy called Mike Brown.
There are a couple of familiar names in the property.
Exactly, and they're kind of old hands in property, and they set up, they very successfully ran a company called Max Property, which was bought, I think, by a US private equity company. Anyway, it was bought for a good deal more than it was floated for 5 years previously.
I'm glad you say that because Jonas mentioned something there that, you know, refinancing. So yes, obviously you have to borrow to build up these portfolios. But you know, refinancing is a word that came and bit a lot of people on the backsides during the recession, the Great Recession. But you know, I guess when you've got blue chip tenants like this and experienced management, then you know, refinancing risk is pretty minimal with this as well.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, some of the deals that they're being offered, I mean, some property companies are getting part of their debt refinanced at fixed rates for 10 years, which
You were saying Aviva 3. Who was it?
I can't remember who it was who refinanced.
Someone's got a 10-year fixed rate deal for 3.something percent,
3.84% from Aviva.
Helical Bar,
that's right.
Again, and a bit Mike Slade.
It's actually, yes, there is a link, because Mike Brown, who's now at Pressbury, was Mike Slade's kind of right-hand man.
It's a small industry.
Family industry,
indeed. But yeah, back to guys that know what they're doing, and these are one of them.
Yeah,
these absolutely. Are definitely one of them. Okay, thank you. Jonas, I mean... It's kind of niche, but let's talk about another niche income story that you've been following for quite some time, which is the funding of civil litigation. We had two results this week in this area. Tell us about the Burford Capital and Juridica.
Yeah, well, Burford Capital's been spent a couple of years trying to convince people they weren't ambulance chasers, which obviously is a sector that has a less of a reputation. But they operate mainly in America, and quite simply they have an investment manager who identifies cases where people would like to pursue civil litigation, but because they don't have the money or the time or both, they present the case and Burford simply puts up the money. And obviously when they win, and they, I don't think they've lost yet, when they win, they just take a nice chunk out of the damages. Trouble is, it's very lumpy. You can win a case and somebody doesn't pay up, or you might find that their company structure is so complex it'll take years and years and years to get through. But the returns, when they do come, although they're lumpy, are very impressive. Juridica is a little bit more complex because it has a different structure, but the yield at the moment is over 17%, 17.2%. But next year it might not be 17.2%. It depends on how many cases mature and how much money they get.
But generally speaking, it does offer a substantial income, substantial dividends.
Very much so, yeah.
Maybe not of that level, but certainly attractive.
Yes, there's a certain risk involved, I suppose, because obviously if they lose all their cases, you won't get anything. But in the case of Juridica, I think they're trading about 30% discount to net asset value. So,
what's their track record like in terms of the success rate on cases?
They're both superb.
Yeah, they're both
based. I think there was an earlier one operated out of Australia, and that's really what keyed it all off, and their track record is just unbelievable.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, it's just another example of the kind of both Secure Income, Juridica, and Burford Capital, so the kind of places you can go and find income.
Niche income.
Obviously.
And this was what I was writing about in Taking Stock.
Because
I think there's a strong argument to say, you know, that the hunt for yield obviously is a net by now a very familiar theme of the UK equity market. I mean, it has been since the Bank of England cut its rates to 0.5% in March 2009, so that's 6 years ago this month. And it's just built and built, this theme, as debt rates have fallen further. But the argument I was making was that the pension reforms, so, you know, the fact that even the 5 million existing annuitants might, if they want, I mean, subject to the caveats we were talking about before, want to cash in their annuities, but people coming into the retirement market will probably stay invested now, whether that's in a drawdown product or just in the equity market taking a yield. But anyway, that there will be a greater need than ever for yielding shares
or assets generally.
But
we like shares.
Shares are, you know, liquid, transparent, and.
But I guess
have a long track record.
One of the problems you address in your column, and this is what I want to discuss now, and this is why I want to bring Mark back into this, because it involves oil, is that a lot of what I've traditionally seen is the big dividend paying sectors, pharma, tobacco, oil.
Yeah,
these are industries that face very uncertain futures in some respects. So they have been well known for their cash generation. But, you know, tobacco, smoking, smoking use is in decline.
Plain packaging only this week.
But it is in decline. Smoking rates have been in decline for years.
Absolutely.
Pharmaceutical, the giants, they face the risk of replenishing their portfolio. It's harder to create new treatments that make it to market. And the generic risk is huge there. Mm-hmm. And oil, again, is something we...
Well, oil is an interesting one because the main issue at the moment is cyclical. Everyone's worried about, you know.
We assume it's cyclical,
right? Yeah, but I mean, it's a supply glut and so forth. But the longer term story is there could be an argument. Will oil still be used in 30 years' time? That is the big question. It's a bit like Warren Buffett's obviously fond of saying people will be buying insurance and drinking Coca-Cola in 100 years' time. You know, his consumer brands. In 100 years' time, it's hard to make that argument for BP and Shell.
Well, do people go and buy? You know, do people say, "Oh, well, I'm not stopping at that Tesco petrol station. I only buy BP." It doesn't really work in the same way. You buy petrol because you need petrol.
Yeah, exactly.
It's what it is.
If cars get ever more fuel efficient, and you know, the headlines are dominated by electric cars these days.
True. I mean, this week I think we saw some news from Dyson, you know, the Hoover manufacturer, who's investing in a sort of venture capital basis in a battery company, who's, you know, developing these much more efficient batteries that will massively reduce the size of the batteries required to power electric cars. And, you know, if you reduce the size, you can have more of them. These things can go on for ever and ever rather than the limited mileage that they can do at the moment. I'm in the market for a car, as I'm pretty sure I mentioned recently. And, you know, I'm looking at mileages that you can get out of cars these days, and it's not really 70 miles a gallon. Really? It's insane. I mean, you know, 20 years ago, you were talking half of that at the very best. I mean, the technology is moving on at a rate of knots. So I guess, you know, there was often a discussion around peak oil. You know, when are we going to run out of oil? But now I think perhaps the discussion has shifted to, do we have too much oil? Do we have more oil than we will ever need because of the developments in energy efficiency?
Well, the point is that we have passed peak oil in a sense, in that we've passed the point at which we've passed the point where over 51% of easily extractable oil has been used. That much is true. So what we have left is stuff that's either deeper in the ground, deeper underwater, harder to get at, harder to extract, and more expensive. On that, but I mean, there's nothing to suggest that 30 years down the track that the world will be using any less oil. It just might be used in very different ways. When you look at the growth is coming from Asian markets, and there's still so much capacity there that can be taken up. But it is true that when you look at alternative power sources, electrical cars, for instance, that's going to become an increasingly more important part of the mix. You know, hybrid cars, different designs are coming out every other week now. Only last week I read that Peugeot are releasing a compressed air petrol hybrid, which could point to the future as well.
I don't even understand what that means.
Well, the very first cars that were produced were powered by compressed air.
Okay.
Prior to internal combustion engines.
We like a bit of history on this program.
And in fact, if you go to Schiphol Airport, you find that all the vehicles there are using compressed air. It's just another facet of how it's changing quite rapidly. With the big oil companies at the moment, we know that they're cutting back their capital costs, trying to free up as much cash as they can over the next couple of years to sustain their dividend rates.
Shell's been quite unambiguous in its commitments, hasn't it?
Well, absolutely. They've realised this is the main supportive element for the share price. Mm. So I think near term, our readers needn't worry. Over the long term, companies like BP and Shell could transform themselves. Already there's a push away for... They used to be absolutely obsessed by their reserve capability. That is no longer the case, and that's partly down to the fact that national oil companies hold sway in that area. Big operators like BP and Shell, Exxon, Chevron are brought in under license basis now, which never used to be the case. Mm. So over time, you might see them converting into a type of quasi oil service function in closer sort of cooperation with national oil companies. This is already happening. So, you know, rather than the oil market itself changing, the companies themselves might change.
Well, I mean, it sounds like whatever happens, there's some big change ahead of this industry, and I don't think we should take for granted that it will continue to operate in the way it does now and pay the dividends that it does now in the same way and backed by the same cash flows.
Yeah, that would just be a lazy assumption, but I think in the near term, our readers needn't worry about the dividends.
Indeed. Well, I saw it, because we've got a solar eclipse today, if... We're actually recording this Thursday, but it'll probably be published on Friday. We've got a solar eclipse, and I actually, there is a genuine concern across much of Europe that there is so much solar capacity plugged into the grid that the 2.5 minutes that the sun will be obscured could actually cause a bit of a hiccup. And it's, you know, I was really struck by this and how symptomatic it is of the changing energy mix and you know, how perhaps the hydrocarbon economy is not, you know, here forever.
But and I think these. I mean, as I was saying to you earlier, John. I mean, I met recently with the head of equities at Henderson Group, Matt Harrison, and in a more speculative moment, he did sort of say, well, he wondered whether selling oil stocks would be, you know, one of the big calls of his later career.
I might just add as well that the mix as well, the production mix is being slanted ever more towards natural gas as well. And over the long term, the fundamentals are more supportive for that.
I would agree with that, actually.
More and more of our electricity is being generated through natural gas. And plus, there's the link to agriculture as well. The fertilizer industry depends on the natural gas industry.
I would agree with that. As I said, I think, you know, in terms of even if you have an electric car, you need to generate that electricity somehow. And, you know, the reality is that we're never going to build enough nuclear capacity to completely replace the hydrocarbon generating base, and we don't want to burn coal. So the logical,
it's a very long-term story.
The logical conclusion is that natural gas will be around for some time to come.
Yeah.
Okay. Let us talk about another aspect of income, which Jonas has covered this week in our cover feature, and that is buy-to-let property. So pension freedom. Pensioners are going to be cashing in their pensions, going out and buying rental property. Mm. Good idea or not, Jonas?
Well, let me make it clear. I'm very much in favour of the concept of buy-to-let, but I think some people have got a bit ahead of themselves, because releasing money from a pension pot will provide a supplementary source of finance, but it won't supply the whole lot. Mm. There's a huge amount of ignorance, and when I say ignorance, not ignorant people, but ignorance about what the new rules imply. You're allowed to take 25% tax-free. A recent survey has shown that two-thirds of potential or up-and-coming pensioners don't realise that. Mm. So if you think that on April the 6th you can walk out of your pension provider with a cheque, you're deluding yourself. It won't happen. There are going to be about 300,000 expected inquiries on day one, and the advisory structure will melt because you can't set out a big decision like that in just half an hour chat.
Oh, this is the pension guidance service that's been set up through Citizen Advice Bureau, I think it is.
And also, you know, if you take out the whole lot, you can pay 20% to 45% in tax. So you could virtually halve your pension pot before you did anything, which is clearly not an option. But if you want to use some of it, yeah, fine. But you'll have to get a buy-to-let mortgage. You can get a mortgage now if you're older. Or you can, you know, sell your house and buy a smaller house, release capital. But the average pension pot is about 65,000. So the average, I know that's an average. So there's a lot smaller and a lot bigger, or a few bigger. But initially, you'll be able to draw down 17,000 quid cash tax free.
Not going to get far with that in the UK property market. Okay, so I guess, I mean, the overall point you're making there is that the speculation that Pension Freedom Day will see a surge of pensioners, silver landlords, as I think you described them, heading to the estate agents to buy up buy-to-let property en masse is just simply not going to happen.
It's not going to happen.
No. Okay. But there may be some who are in a privileged position where they perhaps have a little bit more to play with. I think you mentioned in your feature that the mortgage rules may be loosened up so that it becomes easier for someone over 65 to actually take out a buy-to-let mortgage.
Yeah, you can already get a buy-to-let mortgage. They're being offered for people under 70. Now, obviously, there are problems with that in as much as when you die, it has to be repaid. Mm. Now, the people who inherit your estate could elect to stump up the money and keep on the buy-to-let. And obviously the premiums or life insurance premiums for a 75-year-old, for example, on a mortgage would be prohibitively expensive because they know they're going to have to pay it out.
Yep.
So it is another way of raising the funds, but it's interesting because a lot of people have spent 25 years paying off this, and I don't think they're going to rush out to get another mortgage.
No. I mean, one of the things you mentioned that I thought was quite interesting. So, you know, when you decide to become a landlord, I think a lot of people, as you mentioned, and we've got a contributor, Trish Leslie, who's a landlord herself, who's written about some of the way she goes about mitigating the risk of being a landlord. And those risks are quite plentiful. But, you know, one of the things you mentioned is actually try and buy locally. Now, if you've actually got a property that's worth a lot of money, let's say it's in London, for example, buying locally might be difficult.
Yeah,
but I think one of the things you mentioned that I thought was quite interesting was, well, you know, people might consider selling their property, downsizing, buying a small flat for themselves or a small property for themselves, and actually buying another couple of properties. So, but this has nothing to do with pension freedom. This is just...
Well, exactly. I mean, if you've got a £400,000 pension pot, which is a lot, on average, it's a lot. I mean, you can walk away with £100,000 and you can go to Liverpool and buy a luxury flat for £65,000.
Not bad.
Not bad.
Move it to Liverpool.
Yeah, but be prepared for the phone call at 10 o'clock at night and you're living in Guildford, for example, and the central heating's broken down and it's up to you.
Mm. Well, I guess you could pay agents to look after this for you, but then you're eating into the yield that you could get.
That eats into the yield, you know, if they're charging 15%. Then there's tax, maintenance costs, travel costs. So, you know, that 7% gross yield or 8% gross yield suddenly starts to look a little bit less, or a lot less. And as there's always the risk of voids. If your tenant leaves, you're still paying the mortgage, but you're not getting any rent.
Yeah. I mean, I guess overall, I think, you know, we see a lot of figures bandied about what sort of returns, what sort of yields you can expect from buy-to-let. But I guess there is no right answer. There is no actual absolute figure that definitively says what you're going to get.
No. I think that the time is probably past because, you know, if you go back 20 years, house prices obviously were less. But in that time, they've gone up in value, but rents haven't gone up as much. Mm. So the yield compression kicks in. And of course, those people who bought houses 20 years ago have seen capital appreciation and they can gear themselves up on the assets they have now to buy more properties. Starting out now with one property is difficult.
And I think there's a stat in here that 20% of landlords who let out between two and four properties either break even or run at a loss. So the fewer properties you have, the more chance or the less chance you have of making money from it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
Well, that's a glowing advertisement for buy-to-let, I don't think. No, thank you, Jonas. I think, you know, many people might still decide that this is something they're interested in. A lot of people are very comfortable and familiar with the idea of owning property in perhaps, you know, in a way they wouldn't be so comfortable with buying shares in the landlord of an amusement park operator. Mm. So, even if you aren't put off by what we're saying about the difficulties of being a landlord, this is worth a read because I think there are a lot of things that people perhaps wouldn't consider when they're deciding to get into this. It's a big decision, a big leap, and I think this feature is excellent in terms of wrapping up those and helping people understand how they can navigate this very difficult business, quite frankly. Mm. Actually, Stephen, I'm going to come back to you because we did talk about one company that's doing very well out of buy-to-let.
Yeah,
it's one of their challenger banks.
Indeed, one savings bank. Buy-to-let was effectively the reason why its profits grew very fast. I'm trying to remember exactly what, but...
doesn't matter. 20-30%. Very
fast. Yeah.
we like them.
Last year. And we decided to put them on a buy because it looks very cheap. I mean, shares trading on 8x this year's earnings.
That's very cheap.
Which maybe because they're just extremely profitable, and the reason they're so profitable is that they have a lot of outsourced operations in India, for example, and they've got a cost income ratio of 28%, and it seems to be growing pretty fast too, thanks to the buy-to-let boom, which doesn't seem to. I mean, the mortgage volumes are down quite heavily this year, but that's mainly in the owner occupier sector.
Mm. Yeah, buy-to-lets.
Buy-to-let, you know, is still recovering.
And we like Paragon as well. Hopefully. Buy-to-let
space. Yeah. Similar business.
Very similar business. You've had Paragon and Buy Frasers, have you not?
Yeah, I mean, well, Paragon are much more solid now because they've got a deposit base. They've got a bank license. But it's interesting to note that when the crash came in 2008, wholesale funding dried up and securitization dried up. So they couldn't raise any money. So all they did was negotiate buy-to-let loans because obviously landlords were delirious about this because they were buying houses that were falling in price because they knew what was going to happen in 10 years' time. And they just sat there and just pulled the income in from their existing mortgages and worked their way through. So it came through the recession very well.
Yeah. Indeed. Well, there you go. Buy to let, good business if you're in the lending business, but not necessarily if you're in the homeowning business or new to the homeowning business. Okay, well, thank you, everybody. Thank you, Stephen. Thank you, Jonas.
Pleasure.
Thank you, Mark.
Pleasure.
Plenty more in the magazine this week. We've obviously got a lot more results. Still right in the thick of result season. It slowed down a little bit this week, but it seems picking up again next week, which is bizarre.
The AIM season.
Oh, the AIM season kicks off. Okay, and then stock screens from Algae this week. Looks a good one. Sector focus on the UK's pub sector. Penny off beer in this year's budget again. Mm-hmm. But we're not necessarily so keen that that's going to, or so convinced that that's going to help the pubcos that much. As I said, personal finance podcast for all the personal finance and fun stuff in the magazine. Have a look at that. And thank you very much for listening. We'll see you again next week. Thank you. Bye-bye.